May it please the Court, good morning. I am Daniel Cunningham on behalf of West Bend Mutual Insurance Company. West Bend appeals from the final judgment and the related summary judgments of the District Court because they effectively permit the policyholder here, Precacio Painting, to retroactively double dip with regard to the Illinois contractor's credit. A de novo standard of review applies, and we respectfully contend that the District Court got it wrong as a matter of law. Alternatively, we contend that the issues are permeated by questions of fact such that summary judgment was not appropriate.
So let's begin with this ICC endorsement language. It says, we will issue an endorsement to show the proper premium adjustment factor. Why doesn't that mean that it only allowed for an adjustment to account for that factor, not for adjustments to anything else?
Well, it does pertain specifically to the Illinois contractor's credit factor, and that's what West Bend did here. They reached an estimate in conjunction with the broker as to the amount of the likely credit from the national, from the NCCI. And when that credit was eventually handed down, they swapped it. They swapped the estimate out of the policy and put the actual in. This endorsement actually supports what West Bend did here. Now, granted, the District Court and Precacio get wrapped up in terminology. They're concerned that we called our estimated credit a modification credit rather than an ICC estimate. But that dispute over nomenclature elevates form over substance, because the substance of this endorsement gave us the right to estimate the amount of the contractor's credit. And when the actual NCCI credit came down, this endorsement gave us the right to swap it in favor, in lieu of the estimate. They don't dispute that we had the right to estimate. They don't dispute that we had the right to swap the estimate out. The other interesting thing here is they don't contend that this placeholder credit that we're using in lieu of the actual contractor's credit, they don't contend that that applied to anything else. They're not suggesting that there's some other attribute of their business that entitled them to this very generous credit. They don't dispute it. So given that this endorsement gives us the right to estimate and gives us the right to swap, what their case comes down to is you use the wrong terminology. And we suggest that if a purpose of a court in a proceeding such as this is to determine the intent of the parties as reflected in the contracting documents and execute upon the intent of that language, then this alleged mistake as to how we labeled the estimate shouldn't matter.
Mr. Cunningham, can I ask you about the Department of Insurance letter?
Certainly.
Which seems to disagree with your position on the merits here. Did I misread that letter?
The Department of Insurance certainly sent a letter to West Bend saying that in spite of the fact that Precacio is taking advantage of you, you should just refund the money. When we got that
saying that you were not authorized by law to take the course of action that you did. Is that correct?
Correct. Under their technical interpretation, mm-hmm. we got that letter from them, mm-hmm. realized that it was inconsistent with the actual terms of the policy, mm-hmm. and we responded to the Department of Insurance, as was our right, by demanding a hearing on the issue and briefing on the issue and discovery on the issue. And shortly thereafter, we got a response back from them saying, oh, never mind. We're going to wash our hands of this matter mm-hmm. because the issues confronting the parties and the issues now confronting this court are issues about what did the parties agree to. These are contract issues. These are not regulatory issues for the Department of Insurance. So the fact that the Department of Insurance ultimately washed its hands of this matter actually benefits us mm-hmm. because it establishes that it comes down to the rights and obligations under the contract.
Right,
and the
but counsel, in insurance law, as in other areas of heavily regulated industries, like the insurance industry, the statutory and regulatory codes become part of the contract, or is that not the case in Illinois? I assume it's the case in Illinois as it is most everywhere.
That is certainly the case as to some, but not all issues. But our point is, if that was really the issue, the Department of Insurance would have stayed involved.
It has enforcement authority over rate making?
Certainly it has enforcement authority. And it completely washed its hands. And the letter actually says that this comes down to what did the parties agree. It's not an issue of regulation. It's a basic issue of contract law and contract facts. And that's why when they washed their hands of the matter, we had every right to run to federal court and file our declaratory judgment action asserting
nobody's challenging your right to do that. To what extent, Mr. Cunningham, does your case depend on the content of conversations with Mrs. Procaccio?
That affects our alternative argument. Our first argument...
Let me ask you about that alternative argument.
Then, okay.
Because, frankly, I'm trying to imagine how this would run if you refused to cover a particular loss and Mrs. Procaccio came in here and said for 7 years the agents told me that this kind of loss would be covered.
Right.
You'd say throw that case out of court, right?
Certainly.
Okay. How is this any different?
That goes to the question of coverage. This issue is about premium calculation.
Suppose Mrs. Procaccio says that they promised me a 15% rebate every year, orally.
We would say, first, let's look to the terms of the policy.
My question is about the extent to which your theory depends upon oral conversations with the policyholder. Because the shoe is on the other foot.
Sure.
Right?
Yes.
So how could we adopt your alternative theory without essentially destroying summary judgment in insurance coverage and premium disputes? If policyholders come forward with testimony, I was told something different.
If in that circumstance you're dealing with a contract that's actually an integrated contract, then there would be serious parole evidence issues. We contend that the circumstances are different here and that these are not integrated contracts and workers' compensation.
You've got a clause that says, where's the language here? You're not going to allow oral variations of this, are you? Terms of this policy may not be changed or waived except by endorsement issued by us to be part of this policy. Right?
Certainly.
And this is the only agreements relating to this insurance are stated in this policy. So no separate oral warranties, side agreements, or anything, right?
Correct.
How's that not an integration clause?
Because workers' compensation policies, including this policy, are subject to constant revision and endorsement. Workers' comp, unlike any other form of insurance, is subject to revision because the information that controls premium calculation isn't available on the day that you issue the policy. That information only comes available during the life of the policy. So anytime you pick up a workers' compensation policy, there's always 100 endorsements on top, and at the bottom is the actual policy language. The information simply isn't available. It isn't integrated. The documents are living, breathing documents. And as a result, endorsement is allowed. They're not integrated.
Oral modification is allowed?
Oral modification is not allowed. Our point is modification by endorsement is certainly allowed.
Now, is that I'm new to this particular little wrinkle here. Are there any limits on what the insurer can do by way of endorsements? It looks like a unilateral ability to do anything you want.
It is written in very broad terms. In practice, the endorsements are always made in a manner that is consistent with the rest of the policy, with the original body of the policy. So, for example, the endorsements that we make with regard to premium calculation are consistent with the Illinois Contracting Classification Premium Adjustment Endorsement, which is the endorsement which we think dictates judgment or should have dictated denial of the motion for summary judgment below as a matter of law. So the subsequent endorsements in practice are consistent with the original provisions.
Let me try to ask the question again.
Sure.
What limits are imposed upon your ability to make unilateral endorsements to your benefit?
The good faith obligation to deal with your customer, your policyholder, and the good faith.
How about the limits imposed by the statutory scheme?
Absolutely, the limits apply to the things that are specified in the actual statutory scheme. But the statutory scheme that I think you're referring to doesn't involve the Illinois contractor's credit. That issue is resolved entirely based upon this endorsement. And it's the endorsement that gave us the right to estimate and gave us the right to swap the actual credit in for the estimated credit.
Because as I understand it, the terms of that Illinois contractor's classification credit are set by some external organization or agency, and then you just do a mathematical calculation or some sort of, not an actuarial calculation, but a mathematical calculation based on the number of employees.
The amount of the credit is set by the NCCI, but the terms of the endorsement are actually set forth in the policy, and it's that endorsement that we contend controls here.
Okay, and what's the difference between that credit and this this schedule modification credit, which, as I understand it, pertains to factors that have a bearing on workplace safety and vary from year to year?
What West Bend did here is they took their estimate as to the ICC credit and they effectively parked it in the schedule credit.
Right, and that's
credit.
What I'm trying to separate out, what the function of these two credits is in workers' compensation insurance. The schedule modification credit varies year to year as these policies are annually renewed, and there's a re-estimate of that, or not a re-estimate, there's a re-estimate of the ICC credit every year. There's a setting of the schedule modification credit with each new policy renewal, correct?
Correct. And that credit, setting aside the part that we attribute to the ICC credit, deals with things like management structure, safety, unique risk factors that are addressed in that rating plan.
Right. They're specific to each employer. The ICC credit is set, the amount of it is set by this external organization.
Correct.
Based on Illinois industry experience, apparently. Is that
yes.
right?
Yes. There's a complex formula that...
Right. So it's external to the employer, but the schedule modification credit is set annually every year with each new policy renewal based on factors that are particular to each employer.
Right.
Right. And so it was being artificially used by you as a repository of this fronting credit to keep the premium at a level that the client or the insured could afford pending the setting of the ICC credit. That's what I understand happened here. Is that right?
Correct. It was used simply as a temporary placeholder.
Right. So, it's artificial at the front end and it's adjusted at the back end. So the artificiality is removed at the back end.
Correct. And at the end of the day, what we're left with is exactly what the parties negotiated. She ended up paying
Is that negotiation appears nowhere in the documents, and that's why we get into the integration clause and the litigation. But it seems to me that if there was a contract breach, it's both at the front end and at the back end because there was something extra contractual that was done here.
Well,
and so if there was something extra contractual that was done here, the insured has to take the good with the bad, to use a colloquialism,
if something was done wrong on the front end, meaning that original credit was wrong.
I mean, it has nothing to do with the normal way of calculating a schedule modification credit.
Correct. Correct. My point is, if it was wrong on the front end, then the larger credit comes out of the policy in addition to the subsequent reduced credit, meaning that instead of us owing a refund to them, they owe a refund. They owe a check to us. And that's one of the problems with the ruling of the district court as to the schedule rating plan. If you apply it both to the reduced factor and the original factor, they both fail the test of
one,
the court.
If I could just briefly follow up on one question. Your client provided insurance to Procaccio for, what, 11 years?
Correct.
And only 3 years are disputed?
That's right.
What happened to the other years?
The actual documents that would answer that question are not in the record, but my assumption is, A, they didn't qualify for the credit in those other years.
Which credit?
The ICC credit.
Mm-hmm.
There are some circumstances where the claim experience of an insured is so high that they wouldn't qualify for the credit in the first place. And then another possible explanation is that perhaps in other years the NCCI actually issued the credit on a timely basis, and the parties didn't have to wrestle with this issue.
Is Westbend in the habit of extending this fronting accommodation to other customers?
There may be a small handful of customers who encountered the same situation, not a significant number, and we suspect, but we're not sure, that this is probably the largest of the cases. And given the headaches that we've been through with regard to this case, I don't think they'll be making this concession to policyholders anytime again soon.
We had a lot of questions for you, Mr. Cunningham. I'll give you a minute for rebuttal. Mr. Philbrick.
May it please this honorable court, justices, counsel. My name is Charles Philbrick.
We haven't been promoted yet. Somebody else said that. So.
In my
no,
book.
We're judges.
In my book,
level.
You're there.
Okay.
My name is Charles Philbrick, and I represent the appellee Procaccio Painting and Drywall Company. And I'd like to start just by picking off just a few of the questions that were raised. With respect to what about those other years, why only three? Actually, it is in the record, but it wasn't put in the supplemental appendix. If you look to docket entry 43, you'll see Procaccio's reply to the additional facts of the separate statement of undisputed facts that the party submitted. And in there, we attach requests for admissions. Procaccio said requests for admissions that demonstrate when the Illinois contractor's credit was available and for what years. It was actually available many of those 12 years, and the really juicy fact is that as to the 06 and 07 years, the Illinois contractor's credit was propounded by NCCI before those policies went into effect. So the whole premise of, oh, we had to estimate this because it hadn't been issued yet, that's false. Now, the other question I wanted to pick off as an introduction to what I was going to speak about is the question, what is the carrier entitled to do with respect to changing the policy as to premium determination? The answer is a resounding nothing. Neither the carrier nor the insured nor the two of them in concert can do anything to change the way premium is determined on a workers' compensation insurance policy. Those policies are terms on premium are dictated by regulatory fiat, and the policies say repeatedly that premiums are determined by the manuals of rules, which are thick, the classifications, the rates, and the rating plans, which have to be approved by the regulators before they can be used. The parties are not at liberty to change how premium is determined. And that's why the Department of Insurance did exactly what it did here. West Bend came to the department and said, oh, we had this side agreement to front the Illinois contractor's credit as part of the schedule rating credit, and then we took it back later on. That was their story as to why they were doing this manipulation.
Well, the schedule modification credit was wrong from the beginning of each of these policies then.
No, it was not.
Because it wasn't in accordance with the rating system.
We don't know how it was determined.
It was inflated. That's clear.
There's
Everybody
no evidence.
Agrees that it was inflated.
There is absolutely no evidence in the record that it was inflated. There are allegations and there are affidavits containing parole evidence that's not admissible that the insurance carrier calculated a certain way that would be inconsistent.
Well, is there a way to reconcile the schedule modification credit of 51.7% in 2006 with the rating system that was
certainly,
in place at that time?
Certainly there is. It's certainly within the range in which, if you go to the schedule rating plan, that's the key operative document, West Bend's schedule rating plan, it sets out the criteria in which the policy that the underwriter is allowed to adjust premium, either up or down, credit or debit, based on very specific criteria. Now, what we don't have in the record...
I thought that couldn't exceed 20%.
No, any one factor can't exceed 20%. The district court pointed that out because they changed it by more than 20% on the first 2 years. But collectively, I believe the limit is either 50 or 60% in one direction or the other. And I believe that is laid out in the schedule rating plan itself.
But does the credit for 2006 to 51.7% actually relate to the facts on the ground?
That is entirely in the underwriter's discretion. If you look
well,
at...
Well, I assume that discretion is exercised by reference to actual facts. It's not just an arbitrary figure.
If you look at the schedule rating plan, the underwriter has to have documentation in the file at the time that applies the credit or debit. And the underwriter is obligated to fill out what's called a schedule rating derivation or worksheet. So the question you're asking is, what did West Bend's schedule rating derivation or worksheet say as to the schedule rating factors for the 06, 07, and 2010 years? And those worksheets are not in the record. They've never come forward with them and said, see, here's how we calculated it. We don't have that. They do, but they never brought that into the record. They never introduced it at any point in time. It's certainly within their control, and it's something that statutorily or regulatorily they must have. So I believe that you're entitled to draw an adverse inference that because West Bend has not come forward with the thing which would demonstrate how they calculated the schedule rating factor, the thing they must have, then you can draw the adverse inference that if they had, it would have been detrimental to them.
But I thought the proceedings in the district court were running sort of ahead of the full discovery in this case. Is that not the case?
If you look at the complaint, West Bend's theory is that the sales agents, the broker, however you want to characterize that entity, articulated an arrangement. There was an oral understanding, is their theory of the case. And the
right,
I'm getting you there.
Right.
The Department of Insurance didn't wash its hands of this. The Department of Insurance said, what you did is wrong, and we do not countenance this kind of manipulation. And they said, we won't go any further because it was all about an oral understanding.
Right. I'm trying to get at the question of what would a correctly calculated schedule modification credit at the front end of the disputed policy years be?
Exactly what it was.
Because apparently there is a material dispute of fact about whether it ought to have been 51.7% in 2006 and 53% in 2007 and 10% in 2010. And to get at the breach of contract here, the alleged breach of contract, we need to know, and this is your counterclaim, we need to know what a correctly calculated schedule modification credit at the front end would have been.
Right. That wouldn't be breach of contract. That would be reformation. And there's no such claim here. Those schedule rating credits that are applied, that are set forth in the contract as of when it went into effect, those are correct. And neither West Bend nor Procaccio have ever challenged the correctness of those schedule rating credits.
Regardless of whether they bear any relationship to the rating system that was on file with the regulators.
Precisely, because it's West Bend's obligation to determine those schedule rating credits or debits on its own using its schedule rating plan, and it has never come forward and said, we breached the contract by using the schedule rating factor improperly from the beginning. That's
well,
a reformation
right, because
claim.
Because it was to your benefit.
There is nothing in the, there is no evidence in the record that would lead to that conclusion, because these are integrated contracts. Parole evidence is not admissible, and everything that they've tried to conjure to create this, oh, you know, we're being taken advantage of here, is inadmissible concerning oral side agreements.
Well, certainly the objective inputs to the schedule modification credit are not oral parole modification. I mean, that just tells us what was inputted into that credit as a contractual matter. And if that doesn't bear any relationship to what is permissible under the policy and the statutes and regulations, then we can infer from that that there was an inflated credit offered at the beginning.
I would disagree with you, and I'd go to the district court's finding at page 18 of the oral opinion, but it's at page 22 of the appendix and the supplemental appendix. The judge points out, indeed, the parties agreed that modifications under the schedule rating plan are to be used to account only for those, quote, risk factors not accounted for by other rating adjustments.
Right, and I'm not challenging that, but I'm asking whether the objective facts of record indicate that that schedule modification credit at the beginning of those three policy years actually did that, that they the inputs were linked to appropriate inputs for that kind of a credit, or whether the objective evidence shows that it was really this inflated ICC.
There is absolutely no evidence in the record to address that, because that was never an issue in the case. And I raised this language in the schedule rating plan that the judge pointed out because it's critical to the overall intent and operation of this system, which is these factors, the experience rating modification factor and the schedule rating factor and the Illinois contractor's credit factor are all separate and distinct. And the schedule rating plan that you see there has that language of you can't base a schedule rating credit or debit on any other criteria other than what's set forth in here, specifically to prevent the kind of abuse that you have here. Why? Because the schedule rating factor is truly the only factor in the entire premium calculation where the underwriter has subjective discretion. So, for example, the classifications, those rates, they're determined. The payroll, that's an objective factor that gets determined over the course of the year. The experience modification factor, that's driven by loss experience and it's calculated by NCCI. The Illinois contractor's credit, that's driven by the amount of payroll, I mean the how high they pay their employees and their experience. It's got to be under a 1 in order to qualify for the ICC. But the schedule rating factor, that factor is designed to assist to essentially deal with risk factors that are prospective. So one criteria is medical facilities. Two painting companies, one has medical facilities on site, one doesn't. The underwriter has discretion to give a credit because injuries are going to be less severe if you have meaningful medical facilities on site. It's prospective, it's subjective, but carrier underwriter may not use the schedule rating factor to adjust premium for any other criteria other than
right,
what's set forth in the plan.
Right, and if that's true, it's true not only with the issuance of the endorsement for the actual premium at the back end. It's true with respect to the issuance of the estimated premium at the front end.
Could have been, never raised in this case. And so we
Well, it's a measure of the damages to the extent that there's a breach here. It was a breach to whose benefit or detriment.
The carrier never contested Procaccio's measure of the damages in this case. They were set forth in affidavit by Ms. Procaccio, simply putting the schedule rating factor back in the way it originally was on the policy. And both the district court and the Department of Insurance pointed out, once that schedule rating factor goes in at the beginning, it can't change. It's frozen. There's no discretion to change it later on. Now, if you look at the schedule rating plan, it does allow for a change of the schedule rating plan under a very limited circumstance where the insured is coming to the carrier and saying, hey, you made me a debit on criteria concerning medical facilities, and now I've gone and added a whole bunch of medical facilities to my workplace. Here's the documentation to prove it. Please raise it. But that's the only circumstance in which a schedule rating factor can change following issuance of the policy. So I ask respectfully, Your Honors, to affirm the lower court. We have no issue with the calculation of prejudgment interest, and I thank you for your time.
I just had one question about this Topliff affidavit, which said that the way Westpin calculated the premiums is consistent with the schedule rating plan it submitted to the state. What's your view on that?
She's offering a legal opinion, which would be inadmissible. It's also highly self-serving because she was the underwriter. It's up for the court to determine what the contract means. The facts as to what West Bend did are not disputed. And so, therefore, this case was properly resolved both on summary judgment and on a motion to dismiss.
Thank you, Mr. Philbrick.
Thank you very much.
You have 1 minute, Mr. Cunningham.
Thank you. The motion for summary judgment that brings us here today was filed the day after we answered the counterclaim. Briefing on that motion was completed before substantial discovery could occur. We have argued throughout this case that the motion was premature and that we need additional discovery. We filed a Rule 56D affidavit with the district judge spelling out precisely why we need that additional discovery. And I think it's pretty clear that there are a lot of issues here that could benefit from some additional discovery, including the issue as to the specifics of the inflation of that first credit. We did submit affidavits from the broker, the brokers that actually negotiated these deals, and they did testify that that initial credit was indeed inflated to address the ICC, but, Your Honor, they didn't spell out precisely how much inflation occurred and how much was attributable to the other factors. And those are precisely the kinds of issues that we would like to resolve in discovery.
Why weren't you able to get those additional details?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear
you.
Don't
they work for you?
We have a large amount of underwriting documents, and we have many, many schedules and worksheets. We made an enormous initial disclosure to the other side. I don't know specifically what document he's referring to. That's certainly going to be one document that we explore in discovery if we're fortunate enough to get it. Thank you.
Thank you. We will take the case under advisement.